Hello, Bill Scher.
Good morning, Matt K. Lewis.
Welcome to the DMZ, everyone.
These can be difficult times for the DMZ. You know, we're in the throes of a fierce midterm campaign. It might put some strain between us, but we'll find a way to.
I don't think so. I'm so much more locked into the baseball playoffs right now than politics. So that's going to be a little bit of a buffer between us.
So
this is the best time of year, man.
I haven't been following.
This is the best time of year.
I'm sorry?
Well, it's just the best time of year. If you like politics, it gets exciting. If you like sports, you've got the NFL really in high gear. If you like baseball, you got the playoffs. Exciting times.
Nobody tell me how the Aussie Rules grand final last week turned out. I have not watched it yet. Please, no spoilers in the threads.
Well, it's a real hassle when you're on Twitter and people will inadvertently tell you how that Aussie Rules turned out, and you know, before you've T-voted. So,
well, fortunately, in my Twitter stream, all those tweets happen at 3 in the morning, so I don't see them. So I've insulated myself. Don't spoil it for me. But I'm like barely paying attention to baseball right now. I hear there was an exciting wild card game between two of the sports teams that are out there, but perhaps you know more than me what's going on.
Well, yeah. I mean, so you had, Kansas City came from behind and defeated the Oakland A's. This is interesting because Billy Beane, you know, the general manager of the Oakland Athletics, who the subject of the Moneyball book and movie, you know, really went out on a limb about a mid-season and made a big trade, hoping that finally they could make it to the World Series and win one. They've already been just miraculously being in the playoffs consistently for the amount of money they spend, the small market team. Billy Beane really is an amazing innovator, but he tried to sort of grasp for that brass ring, and it ended up disastrously. So the A's are out. It's a one game. These wild card, you know, they're decided by a one game playoff. So Kansas City's in. And then last night, as we taped this, last night the San Francisco Giants just destroyed the Pittsburgh Pirates, which I thought was a little bit sad. I think they won 8-0. And now as we tape this, Bill, we are taping it later today. My Baltimore Orioles will play the Detroit Tigers. And I think this year with the Orioles and the Nats both in it and both looking really good, this is the most locked in I've been. But it is interesting. I start thinking of people in terms of who I know. So it's like today I'm going up against my podcast producer, Thomas Leduc, and Ron Fournier. But each team represents certain people I know. So that's a weird
thing. Yeah, my sense is when you live in D.C., you know, D.C. is outside of those who are born and raised there, people in the political world tend to be transplants. And so you tend not to have a lot of hometown sports fans. You have a lot of people.
Well, that's true, Bill, except that the Washington Nationals have only been around for about, you know, less than like 10 years. And so a lot of people who moved here from other places, I mean, like, it's like the Ron Fournier's from Detroit. That's part of his identity. He's going to be a Detroit fan forever. But there are a lot of people who moved here who adopted the Washington Nationals, and they've done so well so soon. That it makes sense. So I would say that the Nats really are, you know, becoming, and with the Redskins sucking so badly, this is becoming a baseball town, Bill.
But if you want a future in elective office, or you're already in elective office, you can't be seen sporting a Nationals cap. Now, that's like the biggest evidence you've gone native, right? You have to stick with the team from back home.
Well, that's a smart move. Yeah, look, if you want to stay connected to where you're from, for superficial reasons, you know, an easy thing to do is to be a big fan of the ball team wherever you're from. But look, I would say this actually transcends, like, let's put aside the sort of posing and superficial stuff that politicians do. For me, you know, I wrote about this recently at the Daily Caller, and there are only a few times where I think, like, man, I wish my dad was here to see this. You know, my dad died 10 years ago. And it's like when I got married, when I had my kids, and when the Orioles clinched the American League East, right? Mm-hmm. This is like the last connection that you sort of have to where you're from if you've moved to a city from where you're from. where I'm from is not that far away, but it's still different. And it's a way to sort of publicly show your roots. And so I think
so
that
if it is a Baltimore Washington Parkway series, I will not call it a Beltway series because there is no Beltway that connects Baltimore and Washington.
Parkway, yeah, Parkway is more accurate.
Right.
Yeah.
If that's the case, you stick with the Orioles. You don't go Nationals. Comes to shove, you're Baltimore. That's where you are.
You got to, yeah. For no other reasons than sort of nostalgic reasons.
Now,
when it comes to shove, I stick with the O's.
What about Aaron? What about the kids? Is this a divided household?
No, a house divided against itself cannot stand. I'm a firm believer. When you get married, there are certain values and worldviews that you must be united in. Especially if you're going to raise kids. If you're going to have kids, you have to be agreed on some big. The big questions, and I think this is one of those big questions.
Well, I'm a little hopeful. I'm in Massachusetts. I'm not a New Englander by birth. I grew up in New York, so there's one bridge I cannot cross. I cannot become a Red Sox fan, or a Celtics fan, or a Patriots fan. But the kids might have no choice. They just might get consumed by Red Sox Nation, that's out of my hands. My one hope is we just learned the minor league team, the new Britain Rock Cats, which are about an hour away from us in Western Connecticut, are on the verge of moving to Hartford, which actually isn't that big a move geographically. It's about 15 minutes, but it's a little bit closer to where we are. It's more easily accessible on I-91. And so the Hartford team would be closer to us than the Red Sox, so perhaps I might have a Hartford Rock Cats family going forward. That would be a little more easy
minor
for
league,
me to tolerate.
Minor league stuff is so fun, and it's actually kind of better to take your kids to. It's super fun. And I would say this though, Bill, I think you're in the clear because if your kids were 10 years older, they would have probably had to become Red Sox and Patriots fans. But look. The Red Sox finished, after winning the World Series last year, they finished in the cellar this year.
Right.
And the Patriots just got their butts kicked mm-hmm. by the Chiefs. They can't protect Tom Brady. They have line.
They can't cheat anymore, so that's hurting them.
Yeah, so I would say that you may be lucky that as your girls come of age, the fortunes of Boston may not be as alluring and as tempting as they would have been a few years ago.
Well, anyway, we should return to our normal topics in the political realm. I have a piece up at Politico, which revisits a topic that I previously discussed on this program with Justin Green while you were away. And the title of this is "Good News, Democrats, You're Going to Lose." And I talked this in a previous piece where I said Republicans should tank the midterms. I mean, the basic premise is the same, that if Republicans do win the Senate, and if you look at the current polling, I mean, it's still very close. You wouldn't say it's a done deal by any stretch. But just on the top line, if the polls today were true, they would win control of the Senate. If that is the case, under normal circumstances, that would mean that this party has received a public affirmation from the electorate. They support their general policy direction, ideological view. The party itself would likely be in relatively organized shape. They would have an agenda ready to go. They would put that in front of the president. It would put pressure on that president to sign popular legislation or stick to his partisan leanings, putting him in a box, and that would set the stage very favorably for a good 2016 where they could take the White House. However, you don't have the stars are not aligned in that way for today's Republican Party because their polling is worse than the president's. They are not even running on anything remotely close to a contract with America. There is no stated platform that they're collectively running on. You look at the ads that they are in the swing states. They don't even talk about what legislation they want to pass. They don't say, "Vote for me, I will pass X." They don't even get into that. and you have potentially widening rifts in both the House and the Senate. It's a lot of several of the Republicans that are going to be newly elected in safe Republican districts are more conservative than who they're replacing, and some have even said outright, we will not vote for Boehner as Speaker once we get there. So he might even have a more difficult time getting the votes to be Speaker come January, and if he does eke it out, it will be in a very more tenuous place. In the Senate, you're going to have Ted Cruz and Rand Paul, you know, going grandstand crazy and making McConnell's day-to-day life miserable. And McConnell has said his game plan with the spending bills to keep the government open is to tack on a bunch of right-wing rioters to pressure Obama. And then when he's asked, what are you going to do when Obama vetoes it, he just shrugs his shoulders. I mean, what's going to happen is that the parties are going to fracture again, as they did with the shutdown last year, because they won't agree how far to push Obama. So you might just have this cacophony of dysfunction going into the presidential year that's going to make their lives a whole lot worse. So I don't see Democrats losing the Senate as bad for them in the short run. But I sense that Republicans aren't accepting my analysis on this question.
Well, yes and no. I mean, look, I think had you had you framed it, I wouldn't frame it as this is a good thing for Dems. I would frame it as sometimes winning is losing, and maybe there are some silver lining to this. I think you're generally right to say that Republicans aren't running on a much of a proactive national agenda. I mean, there are exceptions, but John Boehner laid out in a speech it's not exactly a contract with America, but some goals. And today, RNC Chairman...
He said to Stephanopoulos on Sunday that he thinks tax reform and a highway bill can get done. And if you want to call that an agenda, I have at it.
And today, RNC Chairman Ryan Priebus was unveiling a GOP unity plan. So, for what it's worth, I do want to mention that. Look, I think the larger point we do agree on. So I don't want to, I think last week we sort of we got into the disagreements over this. But here's what I do think we agree on is that Republicans probably will win the midterms. And they should not take that to be a sign that there's this huge that they now have the public behind them. I think it would be a mistake to interpret taking the Senate or midterm elections that they have the sort of, the public is rallying around Republican ideas. I think it's more a rejection. Number one, I think it's just historical that typically the party in power, the president's party loses seats in these midterms. And I think clearly there's a lot, Barack Obama has a lot of problems. The public's not terribly happy. Now maybe this buys them some time. This allows them to block some bad appointments, to sort of stop the Obama agenda if it wasn't already stopped as this lame duck presidency. And maybe it sort of should be seen as like, the way that Democrats in 2006 essentially took the House basically by running against George W. Bush. They didn't really present that much of a positive agenda. It was mostly... Right. And that led the way to, that helped sort of lead the way to Barack Obama's presidency, which did accomplish healthcare reform for what that's worth. So I think we agree to a certain extent.
But the one point I got into in this piece that I didn't get into before is that question, because the response normally is, well, we're still going to be able to block his judges and block his appointments, and we'll be able to investigate the executive branch. That will be embarrassing for them. So, that in of itself makes it worthwhile. And on the investigations question, I point out, well, the House has already done a lot of these investigations and hasn't gotten them very far. So I don't quite see how having the Senate, recover the tracks of the House is going to, change things. And if you think, you know, dredging up Benghazi again is going to make Hillary's life miserable. I think the Clintons have shown they're quite able to politically counter these sorts of investigations. The judge's question is a more interesting one because under normal circumstances, I would agree that that in itself is, you know, worth the price of admission. But there are a couple of unique factors here that I don't think are well known. Number one, because the Democrats did end filibusters for district level and appellate level judicial nominations, Obama has been on a real been getting his judges confirmed at a very fast clip in the past year and a half, and now the total federal judiciary is majority Democrat appointed, and with majorities on most of the appellate court level circuits, which is very integral. So, you know, the main, I mean, it's always better to run up the score because one of these days you won't have the White House and, you know, the next guy can, you know, undo a lot of what you did. But he's in pretty good shape considering where it came from. Now, as far as running up the score is concerned, yes, the Republicans will be able to stop that day of the Senate. However, Democrats have beaten them to the punch, which I think is bad. I have been critical of Democrats on this score, but it has happened. And what happened was, even though Democrats ended the filibuster, they did not end the so-called blue slip process. And this is a courtesy in the Judiciary Committee where a nomination is not brought to a vote in the committee without the home state senators of that judge turning in a blue slip and essentially endorsing
like
the pick.
Senatorial courtesy.
Right.
But don't you think, Bill, that it's now anything? Like, I feel like Republicans, if they wanted to, could do away with all sorts of things and basically say, well, the Democrats, they took us down this road.
Well, it's very possible that Republicans take the Senate. They'll take blue slips and throw them out the window once they have the Oval Office at hand. But as far as today is concerned, Pat Leahy, who is the chair of the Judiciary Committee, has been adamant that blue slip courtesy should be retained. And he is not allowing nominations to proceed without them. So that has forced Obama's hand. They had some judges clear in Arizona with the blessing of John McCain and Jeff Flake. However, in Georgia, they had a much more difficult time getting agreement from the two Republicans there, Isaacson and Chambliss. So Obama worked out a hard bargain where there was a package of six judges, two appellate and four district, and they roughly divvied up who would get to pick them. And one of the ones that the Republicans picked is a conservative Democrat named Michael Boggs, who liberal activists said he supported keeping the Confederate flag on the Georgia state flag, and he has bad views on gay rights and abortion, and so he is just, you know, beyond the pale and should be stopped. I had written in the past that was an unfair characterization of him because, one, he's been actually quite liberal on the question of sentencing reform, which is an issue that actually would apply to being a judge. The issues of gay rights and abortion, it's less clear how he would rule as a judge on those questions. It's possible he might do bad things. I certainly can't vouch, but there's plenty of cases where you cast a vote as a legislature. It doesn't mean you're going to vote that way as a judge if you are being a fair and impartial judge. And I think you got to give Obama the benefit of the doubt that he's not going to pick an outright racist and bigot in any kind of deal. There's obviously ways to have a deal that don't involve, you know, going that far. I thought he deserved the benefit of the doubt there. And even if he didn't deserve the benefit of the doubt, this one guy was really awful. If you put the kibosh on this deal, I had argued, he would not be able to do any future blue slip deals. And the fact is that the majority of the remaining vacancies are in states with Republican senators. So you basically would grind this whole nomination process to a halt. The activists at the time, when I first heard about this, said, no, 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 this is just about Boggs, and we can stop Boggs, everything else is going to be fine. But the evidence has proven that's not the case. Only two of those six judges has gone the distance. The other four have been held up. And there have been no more other deals with Republican senators since then. A roll call just said last week that this process is effectively concluded. And it's the Democrats' own fault, in my opinion. So, yes, Republicans normally would be able to crow about being blocking judges, but Democrats beat them to the punch. So that's not an extra point in the argument for Republicans actually winning the Senate.
So, no matter who's right, Bill, you check this out at Politico Magazine, right? I mean, yep. you had a very good day yesterday. I think it was leading the site.
Most popular. I don't know if it's conservatives spreading it around, saying, "Look at the liberals," spitting their losses, or is it Democrats saying, "Why is this numbnut throwing in the towel?" Nevertheless, it was doing well at Politico.
Whatever works, baby. Whatever works. Good stuff. All right. So
you had an interesting piece over at the Daily Caller. Your conservatives seem very exercised about this Secret Service breach, which I don't think anyone likes it, but it doesn't raise huge ideological passion in me. It just seems like a bureaucratic problem needs to be fixed, and I would imagine the president has quite a great interest in fixing it. So it doesn't compel me to write about it very much.
Yeah, but you've got, again, you do have this situation. You got a guy who jumped over the fence, who made it inside the White House, and then it comes out. Things kept trickling out, more and for how far he made it in. Mm-hmm. Then it came out that he was tackled by an off-duty agent who may not have been there. Who just happened to be at the right place at the right time. And then it turns out that President Obama was in an elevator with an armed man who had some sort of an arrest past record. So there were several of these stories. The Washington Post clearly being leaked to by agents doing really good reporting and sort of there was a trickle. And so there are a lot of questions about the Secret Service and about the whether or not, we're doing a good enough job protecting the president. But there have been some people or some suggestion that that Republicans, like, well, why do they care so much? It seems like, this seems a little insincere that they care so much about protecting this president. And that struck me as concerning.
But can you explain, why this issue? There's plenty of other issues out there where they might have could have shown some magnanimity to Obama. What is there something about this issue that kind of hits a conservative nerve that liberals aren't understanding?
Well, maybe. I mean, I think that conservatives are probably more likely to say, shoot the bastard if somebody jumps the fence. I think maybe we're more likely to be a little tougher on the law and order issue just sort of stereotypically. And so it's not out of character for us to say, look, if someone breaches the gate, shoot, release the hounds at least.
Is that the motivating factor? They think this is sort of emblematic of a softness, of a political correctness that has infected the Secret Service? Is that that's where this is coming from?
I mean, I have no knowledge of this, but I would not be surprised if there is a sort of political correctness. If you put this in context, if you go back and sort of mark, like, when did things happen? Okay, about a decade ago, the Secret Service went from Treasury to Homeland Security. And some people, including Ron Fournier, have suggested that that is part of the story. But just in recent history, if you look at what's happened, you had the Cartagena scandal where agents were involved in, some sort of a prostitution scandal, which obviously was a blight. Did not look good, and not only a PR problem, but a very substantive problem too. So you had the appointment of this new head who just resigned yesterday, Pearson, and part of her job, ostensibly was to fix the PR problem. Then last year you had a situation where a woman rammed the barricades of the White House, was shot and killed, and one of the officers involved in the shooting was a Secret Service agent. There was questions to whether or not the officers would be charged. They ended up not being charged, but that could have a chilling effect on it. You put this in the larger context of what happened in Ferguson, Missouri, where a lot of people were questioning what happened there, the militarization of the police, whether or not there's enough transparency, whether, you know. And so in any event, you do have a situation potentially where Secret Service agents are thinking about public relations rather than protecting the president. You know, it's like on a scale of 1 to 10, not being involved in a public relations scandal maybe is tied with, you know, protecting the life of the president. I think most conservatives would argue, no, shoot first and ask questions later when it comes to protecting the president. Mm-hmm. But let's be honest about what would have happened. If a Secret Service agent had shot and killed this man, the story would have been a man carrying, you know, an Iraqi veteran who's a Hispanic was shot and killed on the grounds of the White House carrying only a penknife. And, you know, maybe he's suffering from PTSD. Little children would have probably been brought in who happened to have witnessed it, you know, or tours of people. And it would have been how horrible the secrets, you know, how horrible they are for why couldn't they have just apprehended him? Why did they have to shoot him? And so I think they're damned if they do, damned if they don't. But I think it is fair for conservatives, for all of us to say, like, this is the president of the United States. And by the way,
there was, of course, a third option, which is to actually apprehend him before he got inside the White House, which in theory, there should have been a way to accomplish that.
That brings up yet another sort of controversial hot button issue, because, I mean, apparently there was a female agent who tried and failed to detain him physically. At least that's my understanding. And so this whole thing is fraught with danger. But what I'm suggesting is that if any, you know, number one, all Americans, conservative, liberal, whatever, we should all obviously care about protecting the president's life and safety. But if anybody has a vested interest, it's conservatives. The worst thing that could happen to conservatives would be, God forbid, something to happen to this president. Like, we should be organizing militias to protect, you know, to guard the fence.
I saw you had advertised that idea in your column.
Yes.
I don't understand why they haven't taken you up on it yet. That would be a perfect photo op to have the Minutemen around the White House.
Well, is there a more important border to guard than that one? I mean, not only because this is our country and you want to protect our leader, but again, if you care about conservatism and or the Republican Party, the worst thing that could happen would be something to happen to President Obama, even if you don't, you know, even if you put aside the sort of compassionate, humane reasons why you should be concerned about that. Just from a pure Machiavellian political purposes, conservatives have a vested interest in his safety.
Because
what happened in Dallas, because God forbid, if some tragedy were to befall this president, then look, a communist killed John F. Kennedy, and conservatives were blamed, and you ended up with all sorts of ramifications. There's a good book, I think it's called JFK and the Cultural Revolution, something like that, about how liberalism changed that day, and so much, you know. It would be the worst possible thing that could happen.
The martyrdom would fuel
Absolutely.
An extra, you know, generation of liberalism. That's the argument.
Hell yeah! I didn't even go into this in my piece because it's, you know, it's. I didn't feel that I needed to go there, but, you know, it's look. Reagan got you by virtue of being shot. Reagan was able to pass a lot of his, you know, tax plans. There's a rally around the flag effect. There's, you know, we got to pass this bill. You know, Johnson was able to push through, you know, all sorts of civil rights and great society policies. Some of them arguably good or some of them arguably bad, but he did it, by virtue of, you know,
he directly appealed to that sense of martyrdom, and there are a number of those things were things that Kennedy was trying to get past or had bottled up, and Johns was able to dislodge them with the help of the emotional punch of that argument. Absolutely.
Absolutely. And if you take the historical nature of Barack Obama already, and, you know, look, again, I think that the suggestion that some have made that conservatives, that their concern about protecting Obama seems insincere. I'm saying, like, number one, give us credit for wanting to protect our president, for wanting, you know, for doing it for the right reasons. But even if you looked at the wrong reasons, even if it were solely political, conservatives have more of an interest than liberals, I would say, in his safety and security.
Now, why are conservatives mad that private security person was in an elevator with Obama who was carrying a gun? Isn't this the kind of society conservatives want, where we're all packing and everyone's safer? Good guy with the gun. If he was a bad guy, a bunch of good guys with the guns, it all would have worked out, right?
Well, that's a good question, and it does. I mean, I think it does show a little bit of, it spotlights some, you know, I don't know, hypocrisy or whatever, contradictions on the conservative side that everyone should be carrying concealed weapons. I do think, though, in fairness, it's safe to say that even if you generally believe that everyone should be packing heat, that the idea that someone with a record would be in an elevator, you know, with a past criminal record, I think that's true, Bill, that this person had some sort of a past criminal record, would be that physically.
He did his time. He has his Second Amendment rights. He's earning his keep, for giving his security to others. I think he has the right next to the president with a gun on his holster.
Yeah, I still think that it's common. You know, it would just sort of be common sense that maybe he shouldn't be in an elevator with the president, you know, carrying a gun. By the way, I was at, what's it called? Joe's, I'm trying to think of the place. Anyway, Obama had dinner at this place yesterday. It's in D.C. It's on like 15th and H Street. Super good seafood and steak place. I was there at 12:30 for lunch yesterday. And the Secret Service was there. I assume it was them. And I got patted down. I got, you know, everybody that went to lunch there went through, phones out, you know, security checks. And then President Obama ended up having dinner there last night at around 5:30. So I can vouch for the fact that they were on duty, a good 5 hours early, checking everyone who came into that place. So they're stepping up their game, and it's good to see.
You feel Obama generally has good culinary taste? I know he eats out in D.C. a lot. You tend to know where he goes, and you approve?
Joe's, I think it's called Joe's Stone Crab or something like that. This place is super good. I highly recommend it. If you're in the D.C. area, very good at lunch, reasonable prices, and get, you know, the seafood chopped salad is amazing. I recommend that. You can't go wrong there. President Obama, say what you will about him, good taste in food, goes to good restaurants, and he's been to my neighborhood. I live in a place called Del Rey, and he's been there multiple times. He's been to Fireflies. He's been to the Dairy Godmother. So, I like the fact that he goes to good restaurants, and I like the fact that they were taking precaution before he went to those good restaurants.
Now, before we go, I want to put you on the spot. I know you have a piece coming out about one of the midterm races. I know we don't want to spoil it, so we won't talk about that one. And you got a whole bunch of races that you can't talk about because your wife has ties to folks in her vocation. So putting those races aside, is there a midterm race out there that is sort of, you know, getting your interest? Do you think it's going to be a hot one to watch?
Good question. I think. Well, I can talk about the race that I am going to write about is Arkansas without going into too much detail. I think that might be one of them. I do expect the Republican Tom Cotton to win there. But I think it's an interesting race, not just because of the race, but also because I think that a Senator Tom Cotton would be a significant senator and an important senator. And so I think that he wouldn't be like a backbencher. I think that he would be somebody who would be very relevant and is seen as a conservative, but you know, he's a fiscal conservative, Club for Growth, free market guy, but he's also sort of a Bill Kristol foreign policy guy. So you would have potentially another young guy joining with Kelly Ayotte and Rubio, sort of against, it's nuanced, but sort of against Rand Paul and Ted Cruz. So I think that would be an interesting development. And I think Ben Sasse is, he's going to win easily in Nebraska. But I think if you take Ben Sasse and Tom Cotton, I think would probably be two of the most significant additions to the kind of young Republican Senate senators. So joining with the Rubios and the 2010, 2012, 2014 classes.
I feel of all the ones out there, it kind of seems to be, you know, sort of groomed by the conservative movement and was sort of, you know, rushed along to, you know, jump at this opportunity at a fairly young age, and I haven't been in Congress for very long, and people are very high on his long-term prospects. I don't want you to have to give away too much of what you're going to write about, but I sense that, I mean, and he could well win. I think polls show that he has the edge right now, but people do seem surprised that it's closer than expected, that perhaps he hasn't been, you know, he's still a little stiff on the stump. And you know, there was a piece in the New York Times profiling the race, suggesting that, you know, Arkansas is sort of moving away from having back-slapping retail politicians like Bill Clinton, like the current Democrat governor Mike Beebe. You know, both Mark Pryor and Tom Cotton are both a little reserved, and it's more of an air war than a handshake game right now. But it does raise some question. It's sort of like with Paul Ryan. People thought Paul Ryan would supercharge the Romney ticket. He had sort of this special magic to reach young voters. But it turned out this on the stump, not that he's the worst, but he wasn't magic. And I don't know if Tom Cotton is coming across as magical on the stump as of yet, even though I agree with you, he would intellectually be a counterweight to the Paul Cruz side of things.
Yeah, you know, it was 4 years ago, Bozeman, I think it was Bozeman who beat Blanche Lincoln by 20 right. points. That's not going to happen here. This isn't a wave election like that. I think Republicans are going to take the Senate, and I think they're going to win at least six seats to do so, and they may do it by 2 or 3 points in each race. I mean, I don't think you're going to see a lot of blowouts, you know, double-digit blowouts, but you don't need them. It doesn't matter if you win by 1 point or by 20 points. A win's a win, and I think that's what you're going to see here. I think Tom Cotton's going to end up beating Mark Pryor. I think the Real Clear Politics average has him up 3 or 4 points. On average. So that's kind of what I'm expecting to see. And, you know, a win is a win. And, you know, it's not 2010. It's not 2010, but that's okay. That's okay.
Well, let's leave it on that note. go Nats, go O's. Go Baltimore Washington Parkway Series. And we'll talk next week.
All right, buddy. Good talking to you.
Take care.
See y'all later.